This is the Thirsty Developer, episode number 27 for July 15th, 2008. Riapalooza Roundtable. Welcome, everyone, to the Thirsty Developer. I'm Dave Bost.
And I'm Larry Clarkin.
So there's a lot of exciting things happening since our last show, Larry. There's actually a couple questions I have to ask for you. First and foremost, the question I have for you is, did you get yourself a fruit phone?
No, I did not. And the $5 is on the way. Don't worry.
So do you want to tell people the story of that one? Why you owe me $5?
Well, I had told Dave and a couple other people that probably the best way to get a Generation 1 iPhone is to stand outside the Apple store on Friday, the day that the Generation 2s went on sale, and hold up a sign that said, I will buy your old iPhone for $20, which I think is the kind of the lowest price that you can expect somebody to give up something that they paid $500 the year before. You know, $20 is about as low as you can go. If you say I'll buy it for $10, you're just ripping the guy off. But I thought $20 was reasonable.
$20 is okay. And so, how'd you come up with your logic to $20? That's what I want to know.
I don't know.
You just picked a number. So the idea here was you said you were going to go to the store and hold up a sign, and I said, no, you're not. And you said, yes, I am. I said, I want proof. I said, there's a $5 bet on the table. I want proof. I want picture proof of you in front of a store, whether that's the Apple store or AT&T, but there need to be a picture of you with people online holding up a sign saying that you will buy their iPhone for $20. And so what, you didn't go? You're too busy? What happened?
Well, it's funny, Dave. You got to tell everybody the full story. You were calling my bluff. At 10 o'clock at night, I had a 100-mile drive to get home.
A couple beers in you.
And I had to get up at 8 o'clock the next morning to be out there with the sign. Because it's only going to work if there's a line of people. And I don't think that there was going to be a line of people at noon. So I was all talk, and I'm free to admit it, and I'll gladly pay you that $5.
Funny enough, during lunch on Friday, I have an AT&T store right down the street from my house. And I was just out of curiosity. I'm like, I'm going to drive over there if see if there's anybody there. I said, this is an AT&T store in a small, western suburb of Chicago. I was like, there ain't going to be anybody in line. So I went there. There was actually probably about, 10, 15 people in line. So this was in the afternoon. So I was quite surprised by that. But hearing for all the stories that just the troubles they had with the, getting the phones activated and people standing in line. If you went at noon, chances are the line would have still been there. I mean, I can almost guarantee it just because of all the problems they were having. But so you didn't get a fruit phone. I didn't get a fruit phone. But will you get a fruit phone at some point?
For $20, yeah, absolutely.
And when I say fruit phone, of course, we're talking about the iPhone, right?
Yeah. We shouldn't make fun of it. It's a beautiful product, and I actually want it because, as somebody who does a lot of web development, I would like to be able to see what the website looks like, on the phone itself, And I guess I could do that with an iPod Touch, but that's going to be a couple $100. I'm looking at getting a steal on a Generation 1 iPhone. So
yeah, exactly. So yeah, I mean, I'm interested in just seeing what the developer experience is. I mean, I'm more, the phone's cool, and I think it's a neat device. But from a developer standpoint, I'm looking at it as, what kind of applications can I build, compared to what I can build on a Windows mobile device, let's say. And just what is the experience? What is the tooling like? What is the experience of producing an application, compiling it, bundling it up? And actually, the question I have as a developer, this might be a good episode for an upcoming show, is how do I build an application for the iPhone? Does the SDK come with some sort of emulator? Because if I'm deploying the application, the only way to deploy it is through the iTunes store, right? So what is the experience for the developer look like? I'm assuming there's some sort of emulator. I haven't looked at it myself, but something I'm definitely interested in.
Yeah, I think there is, and we should actually do that. We'll find somebody who's done some development for the iPhone, and we'll get them on the show.
Yeah, so anybody listening that's building apps for the iPhone, let us know, and we'd definitely like to get you on the show. So second bit of news is today, actually, we're recording this Monday, July 14th, and they just had the Xbox keynote address at the E3 conference. So a couple exciting bits coming out of there. One is actually we're going to have Netflix live, Netflix streaming coming to the Xbox 360 in the this holiday season, so that's pretty cool. And there were some announcements around some new games, but So Larry, you know, we're both gamers, and we had this little Halo Frag Fest going over the weekend. So is there any particular games you're playing right now that you're really into right now?
Actually, Dave, as we're recording this, I'm actually playing Indiana Jones, the Lego Jones, the original adventures.
So wait a second. We're recording and you're playing video games.
Yeah. And you know, we're on camera right now.
You're just you're multi-talented, man. How are you doing this?
So I'm not actually playing it. There's this one spot in the game where there's this trampoline, and every time you bounce on it, it gives you a silver stud, which is kind of like the Lego money for the Indiana Jones. And at this point, to get my next achievement, I need like 3 million of these things. So I have powered up the Xbox, and I've got the guy jumping on the trampoline, and I'm just letting it run for several hours.
So, wait a second. So in the Indiana Jones game, there's a section where you can bounce on a trampoline and get these little, what are they called, like little Lego nuggets? What are those things? Studs?
Well, they were called studs in the Star Wars version. They're actually called treasure in the Indiana Jones ones.
Oh,
so,
okay.
So same concept, but you know they've adapted the name of it for the genre. And every one of these silver treasures gives you like 10 points, and I need like, you know, 3 million of these things. So this guy's going to be bouncing on this trampoline for a while. But it's better than me actually, you know, sitting there playing the game.
So you find a point in the game where he's just jumping on a trampoline and he's bouncing by himself and he's able to get one of these little treasures every time he jumps. Is that how it works?
Well, ironically enough, there's a bunch of German soldiers standing around him, just waiting for him to be done on the trampoline so they can shoot him. But you know,
so isn't it cheating, man? What's up with that?
You know, they wouldn't have put that in the game if they didn't want somebody to do it that way. So
there you go. That's how you
logic.
Get by, right?
Yep.
That's makes you feel better.
This is definitely not. This is like a strategy game. This isn't like a first person shooter. You know, you've got to use your skill here, Dave.
Yeah, that's right. Your skills. Great. Well, with that, I think we should get into this week's show. So this is actually an interview that sort of a little roundtable. We grabbed a couple of people and just sat it down on one of the tables at the recent Riapalooza event. And this is kind of our last interview from the Riapalooza event that we had in Chicago back in May. And so we had a chance to sit down. It was myself, you, Bob Lasky, who's our boss's boss, Josh Holmes, and then Mike Labriola.
Yes.
So we just kind of sat down and just kind of had a conversation about rich internet applications, and kind of, you know, Josh and was kind of taking it from the Microsoft side, and Mike was kind of taking it from the Adobe side, and it was a kind of an interesting conversation. And why don't we listen to what we had to say?
Let's roll the tape. Hi, this is Larry Clarkin, and we're bringing you another podcast on location at Riapalooza, Chicago's premier RIA event. Chicago's only RIA event thus far, but
we're going to change that.
This is the first of many, and actually, we're talking about taking Riapalooza around. We got a quick roundtable here, as always. I'm joined by my co-host Dave Bost.
Hello, everyone.
And to my right, I've actually got the director of Central Region Developer and Platform Evangelism for Microsoft, Bob Lasky. Can you tell us what you do?
Long title. I look after our evangelism team for the Central Region of the U.S. Thanks, Larry.
Yeah, and by the way, so this guy owns, like, you know, basically Canada to Mexico. If it's not the East Coast, it's not the West Coast, he owns it. So,
if it's not within 100 miles of salt water, it falls to him.
Much more of a...
We are landlocked.
But we can escape through Lake Michigan, though, if we need to. So our guest for the show, though, so Bob and Dave are my co-host. Josh, who's already chimed in. Josh, can you introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Josh Holmes. I'm a RIA architect evangelist for Central Region, focusing on partners and making them successful with our technologies.
So you do cool stuff with cool technology with cool people.
Yes, especially the cool people.
So. Yep. And my other guest is Mike Labriola. Mike, can you tell us about yourself?
Yeah, I'm hopelessly outnumbered here. So I'm Michael Labriola. I'm a RIA evangelist, RIA evangelist, however we want to say that. Work for a partner organization for Adobe here in Chicagoland area, and I've been working mainly in the Flex platforms, but here contributing to Riapalooza and figuring out what this is all about.
Yeah, so you don't officially work for Adobe, but you're what we call, within Microsoft, we call you the unpaid evangelist, right? Because,
right.
You know, I mean, you're a consultant, you get paid that way, but you volunteer your time to do great events like Riapalooza.
Like the best type of employee you could possibly ask for, right?
Like the free
one
that you have no liability, that you have total deniability.
Exactly. It's awesome.
And you are allowed to mention what company you work for?
Oh, sure. So I work for Digital Primates, is the name of the company. We're right here in Chicago, out near O'Hare. And, you know, about a 20-person firm that really concentrates mainly in the RIA space.
Yep. And we'll put your, you know, company website and your blog, you know, on the show notes, as always, at thirstydeveloper.com.
Nice plug there, Larry. It's all good.
And I'll put mine at codetolive.net. So
yeah, well, don't
or joshholmes.com.
Yeah, we'll give you the plugs, you know. So
and I'll put mine at ilovejoshholmes.edu.
So should I call our sales staff and get our sponsorship money now? Or
no, we haven't talked about the great Visual Studio products, right, Bob?
You got it.
It's all about product placement.
Boy, we're getting punchy, you know. And we haven't even...
I've got a question. Let's just dive right in. I've got a question about partners. So, Mike, you said you're part of a partner organization.
Right.
And, Josh, you mentioned that you have a role within Microsoft to work with partner organizations. I'd like to hear a little bit about how Mike works with Adobe and like to hear a little bit about the kinds of partners that Josh is interested in working with and figure out some of the connections between those two sort of, you know, supplier to partner relationships and get some learnings there.
Sure. So I can talk a little bit from my perspective, and then you can, Josh, hopefully clarify that maybe and put in some technology, not technology per se, but rather terminology, which is a completely different word that would be more familiar to the Microsoft land. So we're a solutions partner, and what that actually means as an organization is that we work with I like when, by the way, for those of you that obviously can't see what I can, Josh is to my left cracking up, and I really enjoy when I can make Josh laugh.
So let's review the last minute's worth of comments from Mike here and say, you know, the terminology and technology foible there, you know, Microsoft actually is very familiar with technology. But you want us to put this into terms that Microsoft, our audience, Microsoft audience will be familiar with.
This is not a problem because we're never publishing this show.
That right out.
Excellent. Okay,
I'll actually translate for the Microsoft impaired. We have solution, you know, providers, partners, just like, you know, Adobe does. So you're everybody's familiar with it.
Really?
Yes. We even have gold certified ones.
Ooh,
is Digital Primates a gold certified partner?
Who certified the gold? It's all good. So let's talk about Digital Primates. Backing up and just missing all up. No, so we're a solution partner for Adobe. So as an organization, it's a little bit different than what I do personally, and I think there's two facets to address there. As an organization, we're a solution partner, meaning that we work with Adobe and with Adobe Technologies, stay very tightly integrated with what Adobe's trying to accomplish, and look for places to use technology that make sense and sort of further the message of what they're trying to go for. As an individual, I work with Adobe in order to do some evangelism. And by that, in this regard, I think it's maybe just slightly different than what Josh does, but it's very similar. And that's that I go out and I speak at conferences. There's certainly an element of self-promotion that goes into that as opposed to just corporate promotion. But it also allows me the opportunity to show off some of the interesting things we're doing with our clients using Adobe technologies. And by proxy, Adobe gets the message out of some of the things that can be done.
Cool. So to translate that into the Microsoft world a little bit, the closest approximation I've come to is that Mike would be a regional director if he was in the Microsoft world.
Right. And our Uber MVP, as we call it sometimes.
Yes. And so John Rauschenberger at Clarity Consulting or Bill Wagner at SRT Solutions or Billy Hollis down in Nashville, Rocky Lotka out of Minneapolis. I mean, we've got a large list of these that are, you know, very, you know, tightly integrated with our evangelism team and our product teams out of Redmond and so on. A great extension of Microsoft, but they're still independent, so they're, you know, a little freer to talk very openly about our technologies, covering all the warts, et cetera. It's good fun. Now, how I'm different than Mike a little bit is that in my job as a Microsoft employee is I take the stories that get generated by partners and go tell those stories out to everybody else in the world. So it's not as much about self-promotion as it is about, you know, trying to get, you know, promoting my partners and promoting the rest of the ecosystem.
Yeah, and you guys are both, you know, advocates, you know, for the technology back to, you know, the corporate side of things, right?
Absolutely.
You know, so when your customers are complaining about the lack of a feature, you know, you take that message back, right?
Right. And I definitely consider that kind of one of our key pieces that we can do is, you know, obviously every company is doing their best to listen to their customers, but the more people that are in the field actually building apps and working with things, the more that message you can get, and the more situations you're going to encounter in order to bring that message back to everybody in the engineering teams and the people that, you know, can really make a difference.
Yeah, so it's interesting that you guys, you know, a lot of people consider, you know, Microsoft and Adobe diametrically opposed, you know, real competitors or whatever. But you guys have we've come together today to talk about RIA, you know, as an architecture, RIA as a platform, not necessarily a specific technology. You guys actually did one of our keynotes this morning together. So there was somebody from Microsoft and an unpaid Adobe evangelist.
I think he's trying to rub that in.
Yeah.
You're not getting paid. Yeah, well, see, I mean, the fun part is I was actually an MVP, Microsoft Most Valuable Professional, before joining Microsoft. Dave actually has the distinction of being the shortest lived one because you were an MVP for, what, a couple of minutes?
Well, at first I thought it was a couple minutes, but then I heard actually later on that it was more like 87 minutes,
okay.
I believe, is the tenure of MVP status that I had. That's because apparently I joined Microsoft at the exact same time that I was awarded the MVP.
Right.
And so when they found out I joined, they immediately removed me from the MVP program.
Right. So I was an MVP and doing a lot of the same things as the regional directors and as Mike. But, you know, I just figured at some point Microsoft decided to own up and start paying me for it. So that's when they hired me.
Is that a hint for Adobe?
I guess Josh is giving hints to Adobe. I wasn't. But, I think, you know, going back to what you said earlier about us approaching the same thing, I think, at least I'll say it this way, I think we reached a realization, too, somewhere in the last day here, that really we all knew that the message was similar that was trying to be pushed, but it did seem like we sort of realized that Adobe and Microsoft were pushing it from a very different direction, right? And it's that Microsoft has this huge base of developers that are .NET, that are doing desktop, and it's using all that technology and moving it to, you know, the web, to that environment, or not to the web, to the internet deployment model. I'm going to keep saying that because it matters to me. But Adobe is kind of doing exactly the opposite right now, which is that they've kind of building a base of developers who are doing more internet deployment centric things and pushing back towards the desktop. And it's interesting that the mix of those two models is very consistent between the two companies and what's going on. It's just approaching it from, you know, two different angles, but it's cool to see both of them coming together, and they're on the same track. Everyone's concerned about designer-developer workflow, and that's the predominant questions here have been about designer-developer workflow. Everyone's concerned about what that means, how this affects what's going forward. And so at the end of the day, whether you're using the tools from the Microsoft camp or Adobe camp, they're tools, but I think the message is pretty consistent, and we certainly agree on that.
So, Josh, you were telling me this morning about a large enterprise customer in St. Louis doing some work with Silverlight.
Yes.
And I'm curious, from both of your perspectives, how much you see inside the firewall enterprise RIAs relative to public-facing internet RIAs sort of over the past couple of months and what you expect to happen as a trend in the coming year.
Actually, I'll let you kick that one off.
Okay. So as an organization, we've actually worked on more things behind the firewall than outside. Our domain tends to be a little bit more enterprise-centric in how we do things, and it's certainly been consumer-facing or, you know, sort of internet-facing RIAs have been a secondary piece of what we've done. So almost everything's been behind the firewall. That continues to grow for us a lot because that solution is very compelling inside the firewall, right? It's very compelling that it's an easy distribution model. It's an ability to update these people because, let's face it, a large corporate infrastructure is almost as difficult to update as a bunch of users on the web. It's the same problem. It's just a different domain.
Yeah, you get to a certain scale. It doesn't matter if it's 80,000 or 80 million. There's a different scale between I have 80 employees, I'm a small company, I can push a desktop application out easily. We're all hitting the same server.
Right.
You know, a large, you know, Fortune 500 company that has offices worldwide, that's an internet deployment problem, even if it's behind that firewall.
Right. That extended enterprise has the same exact issues. And so I think, but RIA behind the firewall, to me, actually initially especially, made more sense than RIA on the web. Because, you know, sort of these plug-in things and the things we're talking about, RIA on the web came from the environment of having to convince internet users that had Amazon and all these sorts of internet applications that were written that way, convince them that this was a better thing that they should be using. And we did that, of course, by presenting a better experience. But internal, there were all sorts of other metrics, right? It's going to save you money. We're going to develop it faster. It's going to it's going to shave time off this process. It was a lot easier to justify those things. So we've had better inlets there to begin with.
Have we really defined what RIA is? I mean, does RIA have to involve the web? I mean, is it a web app?
What is RIA? Internet in the title, so that's one of the things that's kind of fun.
Internet or interactive? Because I've heard both. Right?
Actually,
God, not that again.
Yeah. So Scott Barnes, wherever you are,
I hope Scott listens to the podcast, so we can get this dead and buried once and for all.
Yes. So
say that again.
I said, "Oh, Scott."
No, hi, Scott.
Hi, Scott. So all right. So Rich Internet or Rich Interactive? The internet thing is, it's in the title, the original acronym. And so trying to co-op and change an acronym is not really my style. I very much fall in line with the Rich Internet. Rich Internet is applications are about bringing that traditional desktop application feel out to the browser. And really putting that, that experience and that functionality that has traditionally only been on the desktop, in that zero deployment, zero footprint kind of space, where we've got a secure sandbox, we've got state living on the server, instead of on the client. There's a lot of great things like that. So it's got kind of a hybrid blend of functionality and interaction and those types of things on the client side, state, logic, etc. on the server side as well. So anyways.
Yeah. So I'm not going to add a whole lot to that other than just to say I like the internet in the title, but I tend to think of it as a deployment model, not necessarily intrinsic to the technology. Right. It's in that this is the way that we deploy it, right? And whether that's the web browser, and regardless of whether it's Flex and Air or a .NET app, I like it because there's an internet deployment model and an internet update model, regardless of how and where the technology actually runs.
Well, right. Even if it's behind the firewall, you're using internet technologies. Exactly. Even if it's a rich desktop application, you're using internet technologies.
I think that's a good point, too. Yeah, I mean the internet technology is not necessarily the internet with a big capital I.
Right. And so click once deployed WPF apps would fall near in this line because they live in that secure sandbox. They're deployed over the web. They update over the web. There's a lot of goodness there.
So if I'm an enterprise IT manager and I'm looking at this, is the pressure that I'm going to get to deploy RIAs inside the firewall going to come more from the consumerization of IT trend, which is this is what I use at home, this is what I want to use in the office, or is it going to come more from a cost model, I want to save money on deployment and make that easier, or will it be both?
Yes. there is a lot of consumerization of IT. Is that the phrase you use there? Yeah. So, which makes a lot of sense to me. had a conversation not long ago with somebody. We're talking about a Popfly, and the moment somebody's 8-year-old granddaughter is able to slap together geographic data with a map, with all these other things, and able to kick that out in about an hour, and then you go over to the IT department and they say, yeah, that'll be 18 months. Now you're going to have a real hard conversation with somebody. But, the trend that I take when I'm going after this is with the, really with the cost. And, so there's cost of development and there's also the cost with the users. So, if you can develop something in half the time and get it out, but it adds 4 minutes to everybody's everyday tasks, end of the day, the return on investment there is going to be horrible. But here with rich internet application technologies, typically we're talking about less development time than traditional HTML-based sites. And yet we're able to give a great, rich experience to the users and really take advantage of the power there on their own machine and hopefully save them time. And that's actually one of the dangers here is that it's very easy to get animation happy and over-consumerize a site and, actually cost people time and make things more difficult. I was talking to Larry recently about there are some sites going up that I'm fairly unhappy that they've started using Silverlight with some of these sites because they're doing it in such a way that it's going to cost me time.
Yeah, please don't advertise you're using Silverlight. It's the experience, not the
right,
technology.
Exactly. So, anyways, does that answer the question at all?
Yes.
So, to just end for a moment, I'm a big fan of, you know, consumer-driven things being great sources of ideas inside the enterprise, but I don't like them. I don't like to see it go past that, right? In the sense that I really believe that if there's something that's an RIA or there's a decision, there should be real business reasons for doing that internal to the enterprise. And if you're doing it simply because it looked cool and somebody's granddaughter can do it, you've chosen the wrong reasons and are probably going to end up with a mess at the end anyway.
Yeah, I personally think that this is the second time that we face this problem as IT, you know, the big IT as an industry, because when PCs first started coming in, And literally you had, I'm old enough that I remember, you know, somebody buying a PC, you know, at a store, like before it was CompUSA, it was called Software House, putting it next to their terminal and start doing stuff with it. And IT flipped out. It's like, what the heck is this thing doing next to my terminal? You know, we use terminals. We got the control. We're back into that same spot with consumerization. We shouldn't say no, because that's the first, you know, that will increase the input of it coming into the enterprise exponentially, right? What we should do is embrace it and understand it and, you know, govern it. I hate to use the G word. God,
right,
I hate
right,
that,
right,
but
right, right.
But it's true.
Well, you know, I mean, I came, I was working at a large company writing banking software, and you know, the IT department kept themselves employed by keeping everybody on token rings versus Ethernet. And so we at one point threatened to go out and get our own Ethernet connection and build a bridge between the two. And, you know, built out our own 120, 130 person Ethernet network, which we could do overnight versus, you know, calling the union reps to get the token rings, et cetera, you know.
Yeah, and the irony is Ethernet predates token ring, as I recall.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know,
it's with an even older technology, guys.
Right, but you know, the thing about token rings, though, was that it was well governed and well locked down by the IT departments. And so, and it was really good at keeping them employed. Not necessarily good for the user, but it was great for keeping them employed. And that's the problem that I run into, you know, when we're looking at a lot of rich internet application technologies inside the firewall, is that, you know, IT is not, they're not the people that should be making some of these decisions, unfortunately. A lot of our listeners are listening, are in the IT department, but it's really the business side that needs to be driving a lot of the technology decisions from a, you know, what is this cost justification? And, you know, when the IT department says, no, we're not going to roll out Silverlight or Flex, Flash, the player, you know, to all of our desktops, and so you're going to have to go build this in JavaScript or skip it altogether. That's the IT department making a bad decision, and we shouldn't be allowing that. But it's easier on them to say no than it is for them to say yes. So, anyways, rambling on.
So your talk today was on best and worst practices on RIA,
mm-hmm.
And I think everybody should see you guys present it. I think that we recorded it. So hopefully the recording was good and we'll be able to publish that. But just give us a quick synopsis of, you know, some of your best and worst practices with RIA. And these guys are grinning at each other, by the way. They're totally interchangeable now. You guys don't know this, but you guys are Josh and Mike. You know, you've turned into one word, you know.
Yeah.
So somebody said, "Where's Josh?" And somebody pointed at Mike and goes, "Right there." I said, "No, the bald Josh."
No, it's the bald Mike and the, you know, the hair. So,
it's gonna be difficult to explain to my wife.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
So go ahead and start.
I like to start with the worst practices, which is, you know, everybody's more familiar with the worst practices than the best practices, unfortunately. But one of them is don't build 1.0 websites with 2.0 technology. So, you know, if you need a text, you know, search engine optimization based postcard type site, don't necessarily start with building that with a rich platform. You know, you need to start thinking about that from a, you know, what's the experience need to be? You know, and what is the best experience for my users, and you know, what makes sense from a business perspective. And unfortunately, everybody starts off with, I want to build a, you know, pretty site. And so automatically that means I'm going to go with Flash or with Silverlight or with, and it's like, the instant technology ends up in your, you know, the technology phrases end up in your requirements, you've got a problem.
It's all over. Yeah. So to add to that, I think just to pick one each, and mine's kind of on the border with Josh's there, is to understand that rich internet technologies, rich internet applications have much more in common with sort of a client-server methodology of how things are built than they do with web, okay, or what we classically knew as web and HTML. And so if you don't change your mindset about what you're doing and you go into this thing still building, thinking you're building a website, you will absolutely build something that's going to be a mess and going to be useless too. So and the worst practices front end there is not shifting your mindset, not realizing this is a new technology. It has different requirements. It has different feeling and how you'd approach it.
Yeah, and actually to mirror that from the other side, you know, if you're coming at this from the web technology side, you've got to think more like a desktop developer and vice versa. If you're coming from the desktop side, you've got to remember the refresh button. You've got to remember that you're in a sandbox. You don't have access to the USB drives and everything else. So you got to shift the mindset.
Tracking back to a comment, Mike, that you made a few minutes ago, how does that change the way an organization needs to hire a designer? In the past, you'd hired a GUI designer, a UI designer, somebody that did software. Now you actually need to hire a true user experience designer or architect. Some thoughts on that?
Okay, so I think the first thing is that you're, and I'm going to use a couple words here, and if I don't get it right, you'll kind of revisit, okay? But what you're not hiring is a web designer. And so I'm kind of answering it slightly differently, because that's the first problem, is that you're not hiring a web designer, and this is not a website. I don't care that it happens to be in your web browser. So you are really looking for someone who's a user experience, and going back, somebody who's a GUI designer, someone who actually knew how to build applications. The problem is that we have all sorts of new things here which are much more in common with the web. So classic folks who came from the environment of just building out GUI applications that were client-server don't have the toolbox to necessarily do everything here. So you kind of need someone as a hybrid, just as I think you do to work in this environment. Whenever you adopt a new language, to me, I've heard the argument so many times that, you know, adopting a new technology or a new language is simply about syntax, and I think that's wrong. It's syntax and it's toolbox and it's a bunch of things that go with it, right? About the ability to understand how to work in this new environment. So I think what you're looking for there is you're looking for a designer who comes and understands what an application is, not just a website, but who also understands that it is in a web browser and that experience and the way that people are going to interact with it is still web-centric.
Yeah, so I 100% agree that we've got effectively new roles coming into play here with interactive design. You really got to think more. I'm building a new type of application. What's the team I need to put together? Rather than how do I hire the old roles for the new technologies? Comments that Mike made a minute ago was, learning a new language is all about syntax. And the reality is that's I agree with him. That's not what it's about. Joe O'Brien is a good friend of mine who came from the Java world to Ruby. And, he pulled up his first Ruby applications and, oh, there's Java written in Ruby. You have to shift your mentality when you're going to a new paradigm. And if you don't, then you're not going to be as successful there as you could be.
One of the other things is that it's interesting that how we were picking our words here, because we talked earlier about there's a difference between a designer and a graphic artist.
Yes.
You may need both of them.
Yes.
On the same project.
Absolutely.
But those are two different roles, and we've confused that. We actually will oftentimes bring in the graphic designer and say, design this application. Keyword there being application, as in rich internet application.
Right.
It's not a logo.
Right.
It's not a color scheme. It's
right.
An application.
Yeah.
And if you don't understand a lot about building an application,
right,
you're going to have a great logo and a lousy app.
Yes, yes. And so my background, I do a lot of information architecture and, flowing of information from screen to screen and kind of, how are the users interacting with the information that's on the screen, and, how can we streamline that interaction. I'm not a graphic artist. I have zero skills. Mike actually had a great thing last night. We were talking about he can't draw stick figures. I have a hard time with that myself. Mine look like they're coming out of the infirmary or should be going to it, one of the two.
But Josh, you're a creative guy. I know you, and I know, I don't know if I've talked about this on the show before. There's the crayon aspect.
Mm-hmm.
I think that your creativity is directly proportional to the number of crayons you had as a kid.
Yes.
And I know you probably had 600 or 700 crayons. There weren't enough umbers for you. I had four, by the way. I don't know where mom found the box of four, but it's stunted me my entire life.
Well, I mean, the dirty little secret there is that I grew up without a TV. So we did not have a TV. Instead, what we had was crayons and books. And so, maybe that was it. I don't know. But I'm not an artist. I am a graphic artist, I should say. I'm a performance artist. I'm theater, but I have very few drawing skills. My creativity comes out in many other ways, though.
Yeah, I don't. Josh has handed me the microphone, so I guess I'll comment on that. But the reality is, I think I had many more Lego blocks than anything else, and maybe that's the reason I look at everything with, you know, that particular hammer in my existence.
Well, I mean, it kind of leads into an interesting question. Just this conversation is, you know, the developers or, you know, designers or people who listen to this podcast that want to get into building reapplications, how do they do it? What are some of the resources that they need to tap? Or, you know, start looking into to help them start building these kind of applications. What is the guidance? What do they need to learn as a skill set to build these kind of applications?
You want to start?
Sure. It's actually a lot of the same skill sets that you're going to need to build great applications in the desktop world or the web world. You've got to think about, what is the information that needs to be available to my users. What information do I need to be collecting from my users? And then where it really starts to become different is breaking down the doors of the traditional thought processes around how to collect that information. So, for example, you go to a travel site and, you know, I name a travel site. It doesn't matter. They all have the exact same experience, which is you have a date set of boxes. Sometimes that's one. Sometimes that's three boxes to collect an individual date. Sometimes they will have some type of JavaScript dropdown. Then you have to type in a separate text box, your starting location and your ending location. Mike is leaning like he wants the microphone.
No,
okay.
It's all good. I was actually just more agreeing with you and laughing where you're going. So go ahead.
Yeah. But, so, by the way, I know every airport code there is because right. The travel websites have taught me exactly. The airport codes.
Because I can't spell Albuquerque.
Right.
So I have to learn the airport codes.
Yeah. ORD is not Orlando. It's Chicago O'Hare.
Exactly.
If you put the wrong one in, you're going to go.
MCO should be Morocco.
Yeah.
But it's not.
It's New Orleans.
actually.
New Orleans is MSY.
MSY. Yeah. So MCO is actually Orlando.
Yeah.
So we've become part-time travel agents in order to use these applications, and that's a problem. And so you have to think very creatively about the way to collect information. So I can't draw it, but I can visualize the solution. And there is actually there's a demo app on Silverlight.net. It's the Silverlight Airlines app where you can actually click on the airport that you want to start in, drag a line to the airport you want to end up at. And then you can click on the calendar and drag to where you want, you know, for your starting and ending. and that gives you the list of all the possible flights below without you having to page through six pages of, you know, of different crap to pick your beginning and ending flight.
I was just picturing and laughing about the geography impaired using that particular site.
So this was not for people who grew up in U.S. High schools.
I went to high school in Texas. You know, yes. there's a reason that we're 49th in the nation in geography skills.
Right, right.
Arkansas.
Right. But the one, yeah, I grew up in Arkansas. And but there's a U.S. Silverlight Airlines and there's a Russian Russian Silverlight Airlines. That one's probably more likely to be successful. Looking at that experience, you know, we went from typing in, like 9 to 10 different text boxes and paging through six different pages of information to get to booking a flight to staying on one page. And it's, you know, 2-3 mouse clicks. That's awesome. No text input needed because, you know, we're thinking more creatively about how to collect this information. Another great example of that is actually a Flex demo that I saw James Ward do at one point, and it was an insurance agency talking about how to collect information for an accident site, and that, you know, typically you type in 2-3 pages worth of a description of the accident. This one they had, you know, you could pull up the intersection type, drag cars on to represent the different cars that were present, and actually point to the motion, and voila, you had a visual representation rather than having to translate that to text. And later on, somebody else could translate that to text in on the back end. So, anyways.
So, yeah, to go along with what you're saying and maybe add just a little twist to it, I think the key is that to really be involved in this, you have to be a little bit of a cognitive scientist, right? You have to think about how people think and how they work through things. But the important part there, too, and I'm going to intentionally be a little contrarian there, is that it depends on the user. Because for a consumer-facing user, that scenario you just talked about in the airline scenario is absolutely the right one, right? We want to make it simple. We want to make it straightforward, and they shouldn't be doing text entry. For the person who's doing data entry, for the person sitting in a large organization, we want a completely different experience. And it goes back to that one size fits all doesn't really fit anybody. And that's one of the first things you have to think about when you're building these applications is, who is my user? If I don't know who they are and I don't know how they work, I can't possibly build an application that's really going to be good for them.
And actually, one of our best practices that we talked about quite a bit was, build with the user, with the input of the customer and the user. The customer is the one who's paying the check. The user is the one who's actually using the application. You need to have both their interests in mind, but you really need to make sure that the user is satisfied. And those are kind of the things that, you know, if you build that skill set out, you're going to be successful regardless of what set of technologies you're using.
So your travel example brings up, in my mind, as an end user, multiple devices. So at what point do we get to a level of maturity and sophistication in RIA tools and platforms where we actually see, you know, the Zune, the mobile phone, the desktop, or the browser all providing device-aware capabilities and usability to the end user? How far away are we from that? Do we see big progress there over the next 12 months, not just in platforms, but in the ability of developers and designers to take advantage of those?
So my personal opinion, we're a year and a half out from seeing some really cool stuff, and it's because of the fact that we're just getting our year and a half, two years, is my thinking, honestly, and I'm a little bit of a pessimist on some of this, but the reason is that we're just getting to the point where we can start designing pretty intelligent and usable experiences in a web browser, and we're pretty familiar with what everyone has there. They likely have a mouse. They likely have a keyboard. The landscape of what's a mobile device is a lot broader. And getting to the point where we can actually design really good solutions that work well across the landscape of mobile devices, I think that's got some serious time and effort before it's going to happen.
Yeah, so I think that we're already starting to see some very cool stuff. I think it's going to be worth thinking. I think Mike's right. We're a year and a half out from getting to use this, and you know, across the landscape.
That wasn't the point. I think we're a year and a half to 2 years to having something that starts approaching what we're doing today on the web.
Right. And so, you know, but if you look at like Point UI is a very interesting company that's starting to do some new UI bits around Windows Mobile. And you look at the iPhone interface, and you look at you know, a lot of the new things that are coming out for different types of mobile devices, but those are very device centric. And so, you know, they target a particular type or family of devices. And so I think that we're going to rapidly start seeing pockets where we have great integration with a particular type of device. I think, you know, getting that kind of ubiquity where we have, you know, the Zune and the Windows Mobile and the iPhone and, you know, the Nokia and the Samsung and, you know, I think that is quite a ways off. So, but, you know, think about the context of your users and what information they actually need to have. So, for example, on my phone, typically what travel information I'm needing is, okay, when was my flight? What was my hotel room? You know, I need my reservation information. I need, you know, but I'm not making the reservations from the phone necessarily. I'm typically doing that from the desktop. And so, you know, one of the other best practices we talked about is remember your user's context and remember where they're at and you know, and give the right information for that particular context.
So any last thought before we wrap up?
Wow.
Words of wisdom, Mike?
Wow, last thoughts and words of wisdom. Now the pressure's really on. No, I've got nothing wise to say whatsoever. Yeah, it's the wisdom that really threw me. It wasn't that I had a problem with the last words here. I could throw lots of those at you. No, I think it's a pretty cool time to be involved in this. And I think if you're not involved in this, but it's interesting to you, now is the time to do it. Because the changes are going to become more rapid, not less. That there's going to be more technology and more choices to choose from, and that you can very easily get left behind in what's going on if you don't start adopting some of it. Once again, however, considering I've advocated this with, well, what can only be described as fierce embodiment of the principle, you also need to not just do the technology because it exists. So I guess I'm really encouraging people to go look at what they're doing now, find things that they're doing today that could be done better, and use those as a launching pad for learning more about this technology.
Josh?
So technology is constantly trying to answer what's possible. And Moore's Law is finally coming to software development where, you know, we're rapidly starting to push the envelope of what's possible. And those changes, as Mike put it, are coming faster and faster and faster. I mean, we're on the slippery slope of really awesome technologies coming down the pike, and it's becoming a fire hose that's hard to drink out of. Business is trying to answer what's viable, and experience is trying to answer what's desirable. And we need that wonderful marriage and blend of all three that, you know, technology is giving us what's possible that the users want, that the, that makes business sense. So look for that combination, and when you get it, partner with me and we'll make lots of money. So,
well, with that, I think we'll wrap up the show. Thanks for being on the Thirsty Developer, guys, and thanks to my co-host.
Thank you, sir.
This is the Thirsty Developer, episode number 27 for... Somebody's calling me.